again, Misha. That is, I don't think you'll see me. I'll be watching you, but you won't know when, so just act natural and assume I'm there to help. You just keep looking for him. Looking for whom? For Angela's boyfriend. And then what? If I find him, and if he tells me what my father wanted him to tell me, what am I supposed to do? I mean, suppose I agree with you. How do I get the information to you?
First, Handsome, you have to find him, she says.
And then?
Then I'll find you. I promise.
I have returned to Elm Harbor, and finally reach Addison on the quiet Sunday afternoon before classes resume. I've been calling him on and off since Mariah's visit, and tried him on both Christmas Day and New Year's Eve. I've left messages on his machine at home and with his producer at the studio. I've tried his cell phone. I have sent email. I have received in response nothing. I've been away, he tells me now as I sit in my study. Addison sounds exhausted. Sorry. Away where your cell phone doesn't work? I ask peevishly. Argentina. Argentina? I never told you? I was looking at land. I've been there, I don't know, 7 or 8 times in the past 2 years. So anyway, you left lots of messages. Must be something important.
I've had plenty of time to think about how to handle this moment.
I work around to the more urgent issue by starting with the lesser one. So I tell my brother about Mariah's visit and the missing report from Jonathan Villard. I explain that there is no copy to be found anywhere. I tell him about the 2 pages of notes in the judge's handwriting. All we can glean from the notes, I add, is that the car that killed Abby had 2 people in it. Huh, is Addison's only comment. Then he adds, surprised, you guys have made a lot of progress. And I know at that moment that I am right. Then he asks the question that surely troubles him most. So why are you telling me this?
You know why, I say softly.
No, I don't know why, says my big brother, his voice now peevish.
Because you know where the report is.
What?
You know where it is. Or you know what was in it.
What makes you think that?
Addison sounds more frightened than irritated.
I don't know anything about it.
I think you do. Remember the day we buried the judge? You were up there by the grave and I came over to talk to you. Remember what you said? You said you wondered if we'd ever find the folks who were in the car that killed Abby. That's what you said. The folks.
You heard me wrong, he says after a pause.
I don't think so. There isn't any word I could mistake for folks. No word that's singular.
Silence. All these years, Addison, everybody in the family has talked about finding the driver of the car. Mom used to say it before she died, and Dad, and me, and Mariah, and you too. But at the cemetery, you knew there were 2 people in the car. I think you knew because you read the report. Either the judge gave you a copy or you just took it from his files. But I know you've read it, and I'd like to know what's in it.
Addison pauses. Then he's back.
Shit, he says. Addison is unhappy. I am complicating his life. Look, my brother, I don't actually have a copy of the report. I never had a copy. I just read it once.
Another pause, but he can find no escape.
Dad showed it to me.
I draw in a breath.
Okay, so what was in it?
You don't want to know any more about it, Misha.
Addison's voice hardens.
You really don't.
Actually, I do.
Addison sighs.
No, you don't. Believe me.
I can see he won't budge.
Addison, okay, forget about the report. Let me tell you the other reason I've been trying to reach you.
Addison, likely relieved that I'm changing topics, offers no objection.
Fire away, he says indulgently.
And so I tell him about my meeting with Sally. I describe the night the 2 of them were in the house together, making love, and were interrupted by the judge's furious argument with Colin Scott.
Yeah, he says when I am done. Yeah, Sally told me she talked to you, and that she kind of let the cat out of the bag.
Poor kid. Addison? You have to understand, Misha. Sally's been through some rough times. Sometimes she embellishes things a little bit, okay? The sex he is talking about, not the argument. Addison, that's fine. I don't care about you and Sally. I really don't. A lie, but I see no reason to remind him how wrong it was, especially when I have him cornered. What I care about is what the judge and Colin Scott were talking about. Sally said you overheard part of the conversation. That's what I need to know about, what you overheard. Silence. Come on, Addison, you heard the whole thing, I bet. Or most of it. I heard most of it, he finally concedes. But I can't tell you about it, Misha. He hesitates, then tries again. Look, Misha, there's stuff you don't really want to know, believe me, about Dad. I know you think you want to know, but you don't. I mean, look, bro, he did some bad shit, okay? We all do, but Dad, well, you wouldn't believe it if I told you, and I'm not going to tell you. No way. Addison, come on. You have to tell me something. I lower my voice. Look, Addison, I can't go into the details now, but this is destroying my life. Get serious, bro. Seriously. Remember when Uncle Jack came to the cemetery? Ever since then. Well, you wouldn't believe what's been going on. But it's wrecking my marriage, Addison, and it's driving me nuts. So please, anything you can tell me, I have to know. Well, okay, Misha, okay. You've got a point. Listen, tell you what, I can maybe tell you one little fact, but that's gotta be it, bro, seriously. This is like a sacred trust. I know, Addison, I know, and I respect that. My brother's silence bespeaks a certain suspicion, and why not? I am lying through my teeth. Addison continues to make me wait. I sense something else, too. My brother is afraid. I only wish I knew what of. At last he deigns to speak. One fact, Misha, that's all. Please don't ask me to tell you any more, because I won't. One fact, I understand. Okay. Listen, when Colin Scott was at Shepherd Street that night, yeah, Sally is right, I heard the whole thing, every word. My brother lets out a long sigh. Sally told you she heard Dad say, there are no rules where a dollar is involved, right? Right. Well, I heard it too, and I was a lot closer. A final pause, perhaps trying to find a way out of this. Evidently, he cannot come up with one. Sally got it wrong, as usual, bro. The word Dad used wasn't dollar. The word was daughter. Click. Dial tone. The largest ego on the faculty is owned not by Dana Worth or Lemaster Carlyle or Mark Hadley. No. It is the sole possession of my oldie neighbor, Ethan Brinkley. Over the years, Ethan has told everybody who will listen about the secret appendices he has stored around his office, photocopies of hundreds of files and reports that he somehow neglected to turn in when he ended his stint on the staff of the Intelligence Committee. Ethan possesses considerable ambition, but no scintilla of either irony or shame. And so it is, on the first afternoon of the spring term, one day after my debilitating conversation with Addison, that I stand in front of Ethan's door right across the dim hallway from mine. Misha! He booms when I step into his office. I have never invited Ethan to address me by my nickname, but he has heard Dana use it and adopted it as his own. A few pleasantries as Ethan waves me to a hard wooden chair. So, Misha, what can I do for you? Ethan asks. I need some information that I think you might have. Misha, you know me. Anything for a buddy. So, with a silent prayer, I voice the name Colin Scott. Rings a bell, Ethan concedes. What about him? I wave my hand toward his painstakingly organized and carefully locked cabinets. I need to know whatever you know about him. He's dead. I know that. I was on the vineyard when it happened. Where are you now? He stands up to head to the cabinet. Colin Scott, he mutters, twirling the combination lock on one of the black metal monstrosities that line the far wall. He makes a show of leafing slowly through the files. Then he straightens up, a thin manila folder in his hand.
Gotcha,
he says dramatically.
Colin Scott?
Ethan nods.
The very same. Now, Misha, we have something of a problem here.
He begins apologetically, and I know a lecture on confidentiality is coming.
This information is technically the property of the federal government. If I were to show you this piece of paper, we could both wind up in prison.
I understand.
But I can tell you the contents.
Okay. I see no legal difference between the two scenarios, and I doubt that Ethan does either, although he would doubtless swear under oath to a grand jury that he thought he was within the rules.
Colin Scott, he muses, pretending to read it all for the first time. Not a very nice man, our Colin.
Oh, not nice in what way?
He was with the agency, of course. A dangerous man to have around.
Why dangerous? What did he do in the agency?
He floated.
Ethan smiles at my blank look. He loves jargon.
He was in plans, operations, they call it now. If there was a fire to be put out, Mr. Scott was the kind they called. The kind who followed orders, even if the orders were, shall we say, not the sort of thing that should ever see the light of day. A dangerous man, as I said, for just that reason.
You're saying he killed people.
I cannot confirm that, of course, says Ethan primly. Let us just say that he is, or rather was, a dangerous man. They finally drummed him out, set him up with a little detective agency.
When was he thrown out? Ethan assumes a pious pose.
Oh, well, I hardly think it would be proper for me to share actual dates with you, Misha.
But it was after the church hearings, right? And the church hearings were when, 74, 75?
Around then, yes.
So Colin Scott was already out of the agency by the time Sally and Addison heard him arguing with the judge. About daughters, not dollars.
Ethan, one last thing. Anything, Misha. Anything within the law, that is.
When the agency first set him up as a private detective, where was that?
Maryland. Potomac, Maryland.
I am on my feet. I cannot sit here for another second.
Thank you, Ethan. You've been helpful. If you ever need anything. I appreciate that, Misha.
I really do, he murmurs.
I cross the hall on rubbery legs, unlock my office, slam the door behind me, and collapse into one of the shaky side chairs. I lack the strength to make it to my desk, so I will have to weep here. For now I know what should have been obvious. What I should have understood all along, but suddenly can see with a horrid crystal clarity. Colin Scott, also known as Special Agent McDermott, indeed used the name, sometime earlier in life, of Jonathan Villard. When he had to disappear, the agency created the story of Villard's death from cancer. No wonder the police have no copy of Villard's report. Maybe the judge never gave it to them. Maybe he never intended to. Maybe he lied to the family when he said otherwise. My father's opponents were right from the start. He did not deserve a seat on the Supreme Court, but not for the reasons they thought, not because he had too many lunches with Jack Ziegler, or their true motive because of his disagreeable political views. They were right because the judge knew Colin Scott. They were right because when Abby died and the police failed, the judge did not simply hire a detective. He hired a killer. Tuesday is trash day. I drag the cans down to the curb underneath a wrathful sky, then take a short jog along Hobby Road, which is all my body can bear. I run and I think. I am reviewing my colleagues in my mind, face by face, trying with no success to figure out who among them might have betrayed me. If you call it betrayal when the only obligation broken is the obligation of humanity. For someone around the building seems to be keeping a close eye on me, knowing when I am off to the soup kitchen. Who is the unseen enemy?
I return from jogging. Kimmer has gone to work. At 10, the doorbell rings. I hesitate, then go to open it. Two men are standing there, one of whom I have met before.
Professor Garland, I wonder if you could spare us a minute?
Asks Special Agent Fred Nunzio of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He looks grim. Fred Nunzio introduces his companion as Rick Schrebrett, a city detective. I lead them into the sunny living room.
We won't need much of your time, says Nunzio. My colleague here wanted to talk to you about something, and I kinda came along for the ride.
Detective Schrebrett, meanwhile, has opened his slim briefcase on the coffee table. He withdraws a glossy, color photograph and slides it across to me. A mugshot. I shudder with memory.
Do you recognize the person depicted in the photograph?
Yes. I look hard at Nunzio, but address myself to Schrebrett. You know I do. Without missing a beat, he slips me another shot. Yes, I recognize him, too. These are the two men who assaulted me in the middle of the campus a few weeks ago. Does this mean you found them? They're under arrest? The detective answers my question with a question.
Had you ever seen these men before the night they attacked you?
No. I never saw them before. I told the police that already. Now tell me, please, do you know who they are?
Small-timers, Nunzio puts in. Hoods, hired help. They're nobody.
So you've found them? Is that why you're here? Because I am thinking that if I can find out who hired them, I will be halfway home.
Do you know who they worked for?
Schrebrett again, pedantically.
No, Professor, we do not know whom they worked for. And yes, we found them. Or rather, they were found.
What are you telling me? Are they dead?
A troop of Boy Scouts out hiking in Henley State Park found them over the weekend. They were lying in the bushes, bound and gagged. Alive, but just barely.
They're not talking, Nunzio slips in, perhaps reading my mind.
As a matter of fact, they're scared shitless. I would be too.
An easy, mocking smile.
Somebody seems to have cut off all their fingers.
I do not tell Kimmer. It is now Friday, and my moods will not stop swinging. I sit at my desk, unable to work, furious at my father, wondering what would have happened if I had refused to talk to Jack Ziegler that day in the cemetery. Probably I would have been stuck with my father's note anyway. I would still be wondering who Angela's boyfriend was. And the dead would still be dead, so there is no point in wondering. The dead would still be dead. My mood brightens. I remember the idea that came to me at Shirley Branch's dinner party. In the light of day, I pooh-poohed it, but now I am desperate, and it just might offer me and my family a way out of this mess. The dead. The cemetery. Maybe, just maybe. I do not know if it will work, but there is no harm in preparing in case I decide to give it a try. Only I will need some help.
Where have you been? Asked Kimmer in a tone that I cannot at first identify.
Her eyes seem puffy, as though she has been crying, but she does not look at me.
I went for a walk.
A walk?
For 2 hours?
I had a lot to think about.
I'm sure.
But there is a catch in her voice. What is going on?
Kimmer, are you okay?
No, I am not okay,
she flares, rounding on me at last.
My husband, who has lately been acting crazy, can't be found for 2 whole hours. 2 hours, Misha. Did it ever occur to you that I might worry?
No, I guess not. I'm sorry.
You're sorry. You're sorry.
What do you want me to say, Kimmer? Tell me and I'll say it.
I shouldn't have to tell you what to say.
Then, quite suddenly, the tears flow. I am stunned.
Kimmer, what is it? What's wrong?
Were you with somebody else, Misha? Because I could understand it if you were. I'm such a bitch.
Jealousy? From Kimmer?
No, darling, no, of course not. I told you. I went for a walk. Which is the truth, but not the whole truth. Even now, I'm not ready to tell her where I walked. I do not want her to think I am crazy.
Come on, darling, what is it? Tell me.
Kimmer shakes her head. She whispers,
"Ruthie called. She said the president picked somebody else."
"Oh, Kimmer. Oh, honey, I'm so sorry."
"It's okay," she sniffles. "I guess it wasn't meant to be."
"You still have me and Bentley," I murmur. "It's not your fault the president didn't pick the best candidate."
"That's right," Kimmer tries to smile. "I knew I shouldn't have voted for him."
My eyes widen.
"You voted for him?" She manages a shaky grin. "I told you I flipped a coin."
"I thought you were joking."
"Well, I wasn't." She whispers something inaudible against my lips. She says it again, louder. "Don't you want to know who he picked?"
Sure.
"Okay."
"Actually, I do not. But I am bound to hear sooner or later, so I might as well hear from my wife."
"LeMaster Carlyle."
"What?"
"LeMaster Carlyle."
She laughs, harshly this time.
"Oh, that snake! That snake!"
"I can't believe it,"
I finally whisper. "Liberals for Bush," Kimmer reminds me.
"Oh, right.
Maybe it's for the best," my wife suggests. But neither of us can think of a reason why.
The law school stands at the corner of Town Street and Eastern Avenue. If you follow Town Street away from the university, you come to the eastern edge of the campus. Here you cross Monitor Boulevard, and suddenly you are no longer on university property. The difference is immediately apparent. On the other side of Monitor is a disused park, containing what might pass for a playground among parents not picky about broken glass, splintered wooden swings, and seesaws missing a crucial bolt or two. One wintry afternoon 4 or 5 years ago, I stood at the edge of this park with the judge, who was in town for some alumni function, and he simply shook his head, wordlessly, as tears welled in his eyes. Whether for his lost youth, when the park, if it existed at all, was no doubt vibrant, or the lost lives of those members of the darker nation who suffer here, or some fugitive memory of his Claire, or of Abby, or of his shattered career, I dared not ask.
"You know, Talcott," he pronounced in his preacher's voice, "we humans are capable of so much joy, but we are born unto trouble."
"As the sparks fly upward," I completed for him. He smiled a bit and pressed onward, for the park was not our destination, but a way station, a marker on our road. As it is for me today, as I repeat the journey I made with my father. A block farther on, I reach my goal, which is the Old Town Cemetery. I step through the single-gated opening in the high wall and wave to the sexton, a guileless old man named Samuel, whose principal job seems to be to sit on an overpainted metal bench near the neat little stone cottage just inside the cemetery gates. The cottage is just one room, an office to keep all the records. Now and then Samuel vanishes inside, and promptly at 5:30, Samuel locks the heavy iron gates and disappears to wherever it is he lives. In my student days, when Samuel had the same job, the wits used to claim that Samuel locked the gates from the inside, turned his body to vapor, and drifted into the nearest available grave. I knew this to be untrue because once, as a law student, I was locked inside by accident, walking in the cemetery with my future wife, who sought me out because she was in the process of deciding between two men, neither one of whom happened to be me. We talked for a very long time, and when at last we reached the entrance once more, we discovered that the gate was locked. The sandstone walls of the cemetery are 8 feet high, and the front gate is higher still. As Kimmer alternated between giggling and growling, I peered through the bars, hoping to flag down a passerby. Nobody passed. I banged on the door of the cottage. Nobody banged back. Finally, I told Kimmer that when I was an undergraduate, some of us used to sneak in and out of the cemetery through a drainage tunnel at the other end.
"Did you say drainage?" she gaped. "From a cemetery?"
I assured her that it was perfectly safe. So we plunged back into the cemetery and found the old drainage tunnel.
Kimmer pointed out that the tunnel was no more than 3 feet high. I said we would have to crawl. I told her the tunnel was always dry and was only 20 feet long. It came out down under the highway, and we could make it in 3 or 4 minutes. She gave me that Kimmer look.
And I slept with you for a year?
But at least she smiled, and in the end, we crawled through the tunnel. I told my father the story of escaping through the tunnel with Kimmer. I've been reminding myself over and over. I hold that fact in my mind. I told my father the story, I repeat, even though I didn't. I tell myself again and again, hoping that I will not forget. I explain to Samuel what I want, taking care to be clear, yet at the same time going on at length. I want him to remember our conversations. I want him to remember what I need. I want it to be the first thing that comes to mind if he's asked about me. Today is my 4th visit to the Old Town Cemetery in the past 7 days. The first was the walk I was not prepared to explain to Kimmer. All my visits have had the same structure, a review of the records, followed by a cautious amble around the grounds. So Samuel busies himself at one end of the room and allows me to draw the dusty old registers from the shelves. I sit at a hard wooden table and study the lists of the dead, adding to the copious, but I hope perfectly clear and easy to follow, notes on a small pad that I have been hiding in plain sight in the top drawer of the unlocked desk in my office. I sit, probably for 45 minutes. Then I proceed out onto the cemetery grounds, where I stroll the paths among the headstones, scrutinizing the map I have drawn on my pad. I pass a small plot of old stones that was once a little Jim Crow cemetery within a cemetery. The abolitionist town fathers of 150 years ago voted to allow free blacks to be interred, but not next to everybody else. Several times I pause, making check marks on my pad as I read various tombstones, or noting where the gravel lanes intersect. I copy the names of the dead and the dates of their deaths. I draw squares within squares. My notes finally completed, I leave the cemetery by the main entrance. I wave farewell to the grinning Samuel on his bench and head back along Town Street toward campus, watching all the while for the invisible shadow I know is there, almost ready.
Dana?
Yes, my love.
Dana, look, I kind of need a favor.
As usual.
Seriously, I mean it's important, and I don't know who else to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Dana is cautious. It is Wednesday. I am lunching with Dana today because it is the first chance we have had to get our schedules synchronized, and also because I am running out of options. If Dana says yes and all goes well, I will be able to get everybody off my back and my family's life back to normal within a week, 2 at the most. If Dana says no, or if things go badly, well then, so be it. Munching my cheeseburger, I try to think how to put it.
Dana, look, what I'm going to ask, if you want to say no.
If I want to say no, Misha, I'll say no. I'm very good at it.
A beat.
So, what's the big favor?
No, but, well, when you hear it, it might sound kind of shocking, scary even. Not that there's any real risk, it's just not going to be easy to do. But it's something that, well, it has to be done and I can't do it myself. And if it gets done, maybe I can put a stop to, well, whatever's going on.
Well, thanks, my love. That certainly clears everything up for me.
And the thing is, I won't be able to tell you why I need you to do it, not now. I can explain later, but not now.
Okay, Misha, okay.
Laughing, holding up her hands.
So tell me what you want already.
I draw in a breath, recognizing that I have never imposed on a friend as mightily as I'm about to. So I tell Dana Worth what I need done. It takes me 5 minutes, and she is shocked. She tells me so. Then she considers. She leans back in her chair. Dana turns to me once more. She tells me I am out of my mind, completely out of my mind. She tells me I'm going to wind up in jail. She tells me that if she helps me,
she could wind up in jail too. Then she tells me she will do it. Arriving at my office a few minutes later, I find something else too. An envelope leaning against the door with my name and proper title typed on the front. It is identical to a package I received at the soup kitchen 1,000 years ago, or maybe in October. When I tear open the top, I find exactly what I expect. The missing black pawn from my father's chess set. I put it on top of the file cabinet, lining it up neatly, right next to the white one. One white pawn, one black. The only pieces on the chessboard that move in the course of the double Excelsior. The white pawn arrived first to tell me that white moves first. And if white moves first in a helpmate, then black wins. It begins, my father wrote in his note to me. But if it's all the same to you, Dad, I would rather bring it to an end. With Dana's help, I'm about to make that happen. If all goes according to plan, I will be able to get rid of the burden my father bequeathed to me. Or so I foolishly imagine. But another disaster is in store. I did not expect to be returning to Washington so soon. The bad news reached me, this time through Mariah. When I arrive at George Washington University Hospital, I find my 8.5 months pregnant sister in a brightly colored waiting room. She's sitting with a woman named Paula. She introduces Paula as Sally Stillman's Alcoholics Anonymous sponsor. I did not even know my cousin was in it.
She's going to make it, Paula assures me.
I nod and clasp her arm. Then I turn to Mariah. You okay, kiddo? I ask, taking her hand.
I don't understand. I don't know why she would do it.
Mariah rubs her belly, a gentle, loving circle.
She's been doing so well, so well.
At what?
She was fighting it, Tal. She'd been sober for, almost 2 months. Since just before Christmas. She's been going to all her AA meetings, going to church, working hard to stay sober.
What exactly happened?
I don't know. She called Paula and said she couldn't do it anymore. She was taking pills. When Paula realized she couldn't talk Sally out of it, she called 911, then got over there herself just in time to see them carry her out. Paula called me, I called you, and here we are.
Was she depressed?
How the hell should I know?
Unsatisfied, Mariah offers another variation.
I mean, Tal, she's always depressed.
Paula interrupts.
Excuse me?
We stop talking and look at her.
You're Misha, right?
She says to me. Some people call me that, I confirm. My name is Talcott Garland. I'm Sally's cousin.
Can I talk to you for a minute privately?
Mariah is about to object, but I ask her with my eyes to let it be. Paula leads me off to a corner. In a whisper, Paula explains that when Sally called, weeping, she just kept repeating that she couldn't stand to know what she knew. When Paula asked what she meant, Sally mumbled,
"Poor Misha, poor, poor Misha."
Paula pauses, and I assure her that I do not have the slightest idea what my cousin was talking about. Paula nods glumly, then adds that Sally told her one more thing before hanging up the phone.
"I don't know why he had to get them both."
I frown. Who had to get both of what?
I assumed she meant you, because she started poor, poor Misha again.
That I had to get them both? A curt yet inoffensive nod.
And she didn't know why.
Mariah and I spend the night at Shepherd Street. I am astonished that she has made this trip with her due date so near. In the morning, we have a quick breakfast before I hurry home. The approaching birth of her sixth child seems to have made my sister serene.
You be careful,
she says when the taxi arrives to take me to the train station. I promise her I will. I have to be. Despite this detour, the concrete situation, as chess coaches like to say, has not changed. When I am back in Elm Harbor, I will have one shot at ending it all and setting my family free. I think I've figured it all out,
I tell an ostentatiously bored Mallory Corcoran on the telephone the following Monday. The arrangements and everything. Tomorrow night I'll have the answer. It's all over, I assure Linda Wyatt when I encounter her more or less on purpose in the faculty parking lot that same afternoon. On Tuesday I continue my campaign. I've solved the mystery, I murmur to a bored Lamaster Carlyle. I impart the same glad tidings to Mark Hadley, Ethan Brinkley, Stuart Land, Theo Mountain, Ben Montoya, Shirley Branch, Arnie Rosen, and every other member of the law school faculty who might even remotely be connected to the thing that's going on. I don't even have the words for it, but I know that it is there. As long as Dana does her part, I will not even be a liar. I will know all the answers. From my office, waiting for the right moment to act, I put in a call to Mariah, meaning to check on Sally, only to learn from Howard that my sister seems to be in the early stages of labor. When Mariah gets on, I offer cheery best wishes. She thanks me, then groans, then recovers long enough to tell me that she and Howard have reserved space for Sally at a rehab center in Delaware, one of the best in the country. We are not going to lose her again, Mariah declares grimly. For the first time in years, I realize how much I love my sister. Then it is time to get moving. I am ending my mystery, where it began, in a cemetery. Was it really 4 months ago that Jack Ziegler emerged from the shadows on the day of the judge's burial to tempt me into this nightmare? In my recent confusion, not only truth and justice, but time has seemed to turn in on itself, curving dutifully in the direction of gravitational pull, the pull, in this case, exerted by the mission, the desperate need to know. I am once more on the grounds of the Old Town Cemetery, but not to see Samuel, for it is after 8 and after dark, and Samuel is long gone, having locked the gates and gone home. I'd strolled in around 5, headed off to one of the marble benches in a far corner, invisible from the entrance, and waited. From my perch next to a mausoleum, I cannot see the gate, but I can see the only path that leads to my little corner of the cemetery. If anybody came in after I did, he has not followed me to the bench. Yet I am certain I am not alone. I know some terrifying creature is here. The creature is nearby. I can sense it. Probably the creature is human. Possibly the creature has done violence. Certainly, the creature has betrayed me. As has my wife. I do not even know if I am married any longer. After church on Sunday, Kimmer told me she thought some time apart might be the best thing for us. When I had my voice back, I mentioned Bentley and how hard this would be on him. She nodded sadly and said, "But you can come and see him whenever you want." It took me a moment to get the point. I asked her if she was taking our son. "He needs his mother," she answered. "And besides, he is accustomed to this house." As I sat there flummoxed, Kimmer just shook her head unhappily. "I didn't want it to come to this, Misha. I really didn't. But you've been too weird lately, and I can't deal with it anymore. We just need some time." "Time apart," she meant. "Time during which she gets the house, and I move out." She gave me 1 week. That was 2 days ago. But I cannot be distracted now, even by the wreck of my marriage. I have calculated the moves as a chess player must. I am reasonably confident that my gambit will defeat the unknown but omnipresent adversary who sits, wraith-like, on the other side of the board. When that battle ends, I will be able to focus on saving my marriage. I know that my own actions have helped drive Kimmer away from me. I will apologize, bring flowers, and best of all, bring her the news that the search is finally over. No more craziness. I remind myself to concentrate on the moment. In my notebook are several genealogies and a handful of carefully drawn maps. Each is a map of a part of the cemetery,
each points the way to a different plot. During my visits, I have studied the great majority of plots in the cemetery, not in person, but in the ancient books entrusted to Samuel's care. The cemetery is divided by a series of straight lanes, crossing at right angles, forming a pattern of squares, each square holding a number of plots, kind of like a chessboard. Following the map in my notebook, the carefully drawn grid, I walk along the main road, passing shadowy headstones. I walk all the way to the far wall of the cemetery. I have done this walk enough times now that I no longer need the map. The squares of a chessboard are numbered on an 8x8 grid, from A1 in the lower left corner on white side of the board to H8 in the upper right. Were the cemetery grid a chessboard with the gate on the black side, the lane I am now walking would be the B file. I pass three crossing lanes, labeled in my notes as B1, B2, and B3. At the fourth lane, I stop. B4, according to my notes. B4, if one accepts the cemetery as a chessboard, even though it does not have 64 squares, and if one arbitrarily takes the gate as the black side. Plausible. B4, the first move of the double Excelsior, with the knight, if black wins and white loses. Excelsior, it begins. If white loses, then it begins with the white queen's knight pawn sliding two squares forward. That is why my father arranged for me to receive the white pawn first. Laney Cross was surely right. The judge wanted to fix it so black would finally win. The move is B4, the square is B4. The move is written B4, and I am here at B4. Thin but plausible, at least if I told my father the story of my escape with Kimmer from the cemetery years ago. I step off the path and find the headstone I am looking for. This is my fourth observation of it, but my first while in possession of a shovel. I lift the light briefly to examine the marble headstone, confirming the identity of the person buried in the grave. Angela, beloved daughter. I look at the dates of her too short life, 1906 to 1919. I step to the left, away from this family plot, and on to the next. Once more, a long granite wall in the back bears a family name, and once more, a smaller marker appears in front, in the right front corner, quite close to Angela's. Perfectly placed. Aloysius, treasured son. I examine the dates, 1904 to 1923. Right next to Angela. Perfectly placed. Almost certainly not Angela's boyfriend, not in real life, but close enough for a plausible opportunity for discovery. I examine the ground. It takes 2 or 3 minutes, but I find what I am looking for. In the shielded spill of my flashlight, a patch of dark brown earth next to the grave looks freshly turned, perfectly placed. I bend to my pack to remove the shovel, then pause, straighten, and look into the dark, distant mists. Too many sounds in the quiet. I have no objective way to tell if anybody is out there. Yet I am certain that somebody is. I put the flashlight on the ground, illuminating the muddy, grassless patch, and with a spade I brought along, I begin to dig. Within 4 or 5 minutes, I have made a shallow trench at least 8 inches wide. After 2 minutes more, I strike metal. Crunch. I stop, swinging my light in a wide circle, probing the fog. Somebody is out there, definitely. And there is no point in hiding the flashlight any longer, because the one thing I know is that the somebody who is out there already knows where to find me. For a second, I consider replacing the earth I have dug, refusing to follow the game to its end, but I have gone too far. I had gone too far when I asked Dana Worth for a favor. Dig. I widen the hole until I can see what I take to be the edges of the blue metal box, and that is when a slight
pale ghost materializes from the darkness, and I cry out and raise the tool as though to strike.
"Let me help, Misha,"
whispers the ghost. But it is really Dana Wirth. For a moment I can think of nothing to say. Dana stands before me, smiling shyly. I should have known she would figure it out. She has even brought her own shovel.
"What are you doing here?"
I demand, still shivering from the fright she gave me.
"Oh, come on, Misha. After what you asked me to do, did you really think I would miss it?"
I let this go. "How did you get in?"
"Through the gate, the same way you did."
"I've been here since closing."
"The gate isn't closed."
"It what?" "It is. I saw Samuel close it." Dana shrugs.
"Well, it isn't closed now. I just walked in."
I put it together. Somebody unlocked it. And why leave it ajar? Because this is not just about the arrangements anymore, and it is not just about following me until I find them either. If the gate was left open, it was left that way in invitation, which means that now this is about Dana, too. Bad news. Very bad news. "Dana, you have to get out of here. You have to go, fast."
"I'm not leaving you here, Misha. No way."
"It's dangerous."
"Then you shouldn't be here either."
"Dana, come on."
"You come on. Don't give me any of this me man, you woman stuff, okay? I know you're primitive, but you're not that primitive. Now get serious, Misha. I'm not going to abandon you. I'm not. So please, Misha, quit wasting time."
Well, the truth is, it's less spooky with Dana here, and I might need the help. Okay, let's get to work. We both dig, clearing the dirt from all four sides. Then we both lean over and pull, and just like that, the box is free of the earth. It is a box of the sort in which one keeps canceled checks or passports. As Dana stands next to me, beaming, I brush away a few loose clods of earth and lift the top. It opens on its hinges, quite freely. I glance around, then sit on the low stone wall, setting the box next to me. I leave it open but make no effort to remove the oilcloth package I have already spotted inside. A grin tugs at my lips as I consider all the people who would like to be holding what we have dug up.
"What now?"
asked Dana, growing nervous.
"Is that it? Are we done?"
"I'm not sure."
"Misha, look, this has been fun, okay? But I want to get out of here."
I look around again, puzzled. "Okay, you're right, let's go." I close up the box. I pack up my shovel and, with Dana Wirth at my side, stride toward the gate. Dana practically skips along. She seems almost giddy at the thought that we are leaving this place, and I am rather pleased myself. I cradle the box in my arms, still worried about whether somebody else is in here with us. As we hike, I listen. Was that a footstep? The sloughing of metal over stone? We reach a crossroads and turn right, onto the direct path toward the gate. Dana's stride quickens. Then, something. A small metallic click. Repeated. It is made by a human being. A human being carrying something that clanks and jangles, but trying to be quiet about it. Still clutching the box, I pull Dana close. I lean toward her ear and whisper, "Somebody else is in here." Spooked, we take off, no longer trying to be quiet. We reach the front gate in less than a minute. It is closed. "Give it a shove," I suggest to Dana. She pushes harder, then turns to me and shakes her head. "What is it?"
"Look!"
Her voice trembles as she points. The padlock and chain are firmly in place. Now I know what was clanking in the darkness. We are trapped in the cemetery. "Okay," I mutter, thinking fast. Somebody picked the lock and opened the gate to see if anybody else came in. Then the same somebody chained it again. "We can get out the other way," I say.
"What other way?"
I turn toward the rear of the cemetery. I do not want to plunge back into that awful darkness, but we have no choice. It's a long story, Dana. Believe me, there is another way out. A drainage tunnel in the south wall. I take a couple of steps down the path. "Come with me." She does not answer. I turn back.
"Dana?"
It'll be fine, I promise.
She is a couple of paces behind me, her wide-eyed gaze in the other direction toward the gate. I follow her line of sight.
Misha!
She gasps, then drops her shovel on the ground. Looking past her, I shut up at once. He must have been hiding behind one of the mausoleums, for the man who is standing just off the path, easily picked out in the glare of my flashlight, has obviously been waiting at the gate for us to return. He is a tough-looking man. A scraggly beard encircles his wrathful face. His eyes are hard. A coldly efficient gun, clutched lightly in his right hand, is pointing in our direction. Dana has already put her hands up, and I decide to do the same, especially because the man holding the gun motions with the barrel, making it plain what he wants us to do. Moving slowly, I put the flashlight on the ground. I straighten again. He gives me another signal with the gun. Reluctantly, I put the strong box down too.
Very good, says the bearded man, in a terrifyingly familiar voice.
No, I breathe. It isn't possible. But it is. Because my attention is naturally on the blue-black gun with its bulbous silencer, it has taken a few seconds for my terrified brain to register a simple, stunning fact. The man blocking our path is no stranger. Behind the reddish-brown beard is the ruddy, self-satisfied face of Colin Scott.
Keep your hands very still, says Colin Scott at last. Use your foot to push the box over to me.
I do it. He makes no move to pick it up.
I knew you must have a helper, Professor. Now is there anybody else here with you? Please don't waste my time lying.
No, it's just the two of us, I assure him.
Do you know what is in the box?
I opened it. It isn't locked. I saw a package inside, that's all. He crouches, the gun holding us in place, and slowly lifts the lid. I can no longer restrain myself. They said you drowned.
It wasn't me, he answers calmly. A man drowned, but it wasn't me. I told you I would have to do something about the Bureau. Being dead is an excellent way to forestall an investigation.
But the body was identified.
No. No, it was not. This is a common misperception. No body is ever really identified. Certainly no body that has suffered a few hours with the fish. The fingerprints are identified. The dental work is identified. We assume that if we know the owner of the fingerprints, we know the identity of the body. But that assumption is only as good as the quality of the underlying records.
You fiddled with the records, Dana murmurs.
So you have the box, I point out, fighting for time. You're safe now.
The box was never for me, Professor. That much of what I told you was true. I was engaged to recover it for someone else.
Who?
I'm not here to offer you explanations, Professor.
A silence. I break it.
Okay, so what do we do now?
His thin, scarred lips curl into a slight smile, but he does not bother to answer. Instead, he gestures with the gun, moving us farther away from the gate and along the path into the cemetery, where he can kill us more easily.
You don't have to be afraid, Professor, he declares.